After a festive season of this nature, it may not surprise you to know that I took an early opportunity to return to my place of business in Equity Court, where I found not much business going on. Such few barristers and clerks as were visible seemed to be in a state of somnambulism. I made for Pomeroy's wine bar, where even the holly seemed to be suffering from a hangover. And my learned friend, Claude Erskine Brown, was toying in a melancholy and aloof fashion with a half bottle of Pomeroy's more upmarket Saint-Emilion type red. "He wandered lonely as a Claude," I intoned. "Did he come to work?"
"I came," he said dolefully, "because I couldn't stay at home."
"Because of Christmas visitors?"
"No, because of the shrink."
I didn't catch the fellow's drift. Had his wits turned? Did he imagine some strange diminution in size of his Islington home, so that, like Alice in Wonderland, he could no longer crawl in at the front door?
The what? The shrink. Phillida knows all about the case of the altered brief. Ballard told her.
Ah, yes. I knew my Soapy Sam. I bet he enjoyed that.
No, she was very understanding.
You said you were innocent, and she believed you.
No, she didn't believe me. She was just very understanding.
Ah.
She said it was the midlife crisis. It happens to people in middle age, mainly women who pinch things in Sainsbury's. But Philly thinks quite a lot of men go mad as well. So she said it was a sort of a cry for help, and she'd stand by me provided I went to a shrink.
So?
Well, it seemed easier to agree somehow.
Poor old Claude. The fizz had quite gone out of him, and he had volunteered to join the great army of the maladjusted.
She fixed me up with a Dr. Gertrude Hauser, who lives in Belzeith Park.
Oh, yes. And what did Dr. Gertrude have to say?
Well, first of all, she had this rather disgusting old sofa with a bit of Kleenex on the pillow. She made me lie down on that, so I felt a bit of a fool. Then she asked me about my childhood, so I told her. And then, she said, the whole trouble was that I wanted to sleep with my mother.
And did you?
What?
Want to sleep with your mother?
Of course not. Mummy would never have stood for it.
No, I suppose not.
No, quite honestly, Rumpel, Mummy was an absolute sweetie in many ways, but, well, no offence to you, of course, she was corpulent. I didn't fancy her in the least.
Did you tell Gertrude that?
Oh, yes. I said, quite honestly, I wouldn't have slept with Mummy if we'd been alone on a desert island.
And what did the shrink say?
She said, I shall write down fantasizes about being alone with his mother on a desert island. Oh, quite honestly, Rumpel, I can't go and see Dr. Hauser again.
No, probably not.
All that talk about Mummy, really too embarrassing. She'd have hated it so if she'd been alive.
Yes, I do see. Excuse me for a moment. I tore myself away from the reluctant patient to a corner in which I had seen Ms. Liz Probert settling down to a glass of Pomeroy's newly advertised organic plonk. The old plonk, I strongly suspected, with a new bright green label on the bottle. There was a certain matter about which I needed to ask her further and better particulars. Look here, Liz. I pulled up a chair. How did you know all that about Christopher Jago?
You can't sit there, she said. I'm expecting Dave Inchcape.
Well, just until he comes. How did you know that Jago didn't go to a public school, for instance?
Oh, he told me.
You met him?
Oh, yes. Dave and I got our flat through him. And I have to tell you, Rumpel, that he was absolutely honest, reliable, and trustworthy throughout the whole transaction.
I had forgotten that Liz and Dave were now co-mortgagees and living happily ever after somewhere off Ladbroke Grove. What do you mean he was honest and reliable?
Well, we got our place pretty cheaply compared to the price Fabian and Winchelsea were asking for the other flats we saw. He never put the price up or let us be gazumped by other clients. And he helped us to fix up our mortgage. Oh, and he didn't cock me on the head with a Zulu knob carry either.
Yes, I can see that. But what else about him? Did he have a wife, girlfriend, anything like that?
Ah, hundreds of girlfriends, I should think. He's rather attractive. Tall, fair, and handsome. So you see, I shan't be giving evidence for the prosecution.
I imagine from what you said you wouldn't come and take a note for me, act as my junior.
You must be joking.
Miss Liz took a gulp of the alleged organic brew and looked at me with contempt.
Oh, I'll have to ask your cohabitee. Save your breath. Tricia Benbow's already briefed Dave, the defense. He knows I'd never speak to him again if he took part in a prosecution.
Christopher Jago's gone to La Belle Benbow.
Oh, yes. He asked me if I knew a brilliant solicitor and said he preferred women in his life, so I sent him off to her.
But Dave Inchcape's not doing the case alone. I mean, no offence to him, but he's still only a white wig.
He's got a leader.
Who? A foeman, I rather hoped, worthy of my steel. Liz looked at me in silence for a moment, as though she was relishing the news she had to impart.
Our head of chambers, she said.
Heavens above, I nearly choked on my non-organic, chemically produced Chateau Ordinaire. Thus the whirligig of time brings in his revenges. Rumpel for the prosecution and Ballard for the defense. He'd better sit close to me. He might catch some passive advocacy. On my way out, I had a message for Claude Erskine Brown, who was still palely loitering. Come and help me in the Muse murder, I said. Be my hard-working junior. Take your mind off your mother. Being in possession of two such contradictory views of Christopher Jago as those provided by the Fabians and Miss Liz Probert, I decided that a little investigative work was necessary. I could hardly ask Francis Pycroft to hang around such pubs and clubs as Jago might frequent, so I called in the services of my old friend and colleague, Ferdinand Isaac Gerald Newton, known as Fig Newton to the trade. You could pass through many bars and hardly notice the doleful, lantern-jawed figure sitting in a quiet corner, nursing half a pint of Guinness and apparently engrossed in the Times crossword puzzle, which he solves, I'm ashamed to say, in almost less time than it takes me to spot the quotations. But he hoovers up every scrap of gossip and information dropped within a surprisingly wide radius. You can't make bricks without straw, and Fig is straw purveyor to the best Old Bailey defenders. Now he would have a chance, as I had, of seeing life from the prosecution side. I met him a couple of weeks later in Pomeroy's. He was suffering, as usual, from a bad cold, having been up most of the night keeping watch on a block of flats in a matrimonial matter. But between some heavy work with the handkerchief, he was able to tell me a great deal. Our quarry lived in a 1930s house near Shepherd's Bush Road, the ground floor of which served as his office. He drove an electric blue Alfa Romeo, the car which had led to his arrest. He was well known in a number of pubs around Maida Vale and Notting Hill Gate, where many of the properties he dealt in were situated. He was unmarried, but went out with a succession of girls, his taste running to young and pretty blonde secretaries and receptionists. None of them lasted very long, and in the Benedict Arms, one of the favourite resorts near the Regent's Canal, the bar staff would lay bets on how soon any girl would go. There was one notable exception, however, to the stage army of desirable young women. On half a dozen occasions, the suspect had come into the Benedict Arms with a big, awkward, pale, and rather unattractive girl. They had sat in a corner away from the crowd and appeared to have a lot to say to each other. When Fig told me that, the penny dropped. I smote the table in my excitement, rattling the glasses and attracting the stares of the legal hacks busy drinking of Brandis. I had just remembered what I knew about Arthur Morrison. On my way home, I went to check the facts in the library, for Veronica Fabian had no doubt known a great deal more than I did about minor novelists in the last century. Arthur Morrison, a prolific author, was born in 1863 and lived on into the Second World War. His best-known book about life in the East End of London was published in 1896 and was called A Child of the Jago. I put the companion to English literature back in the library shelf with a feeling of relief. God was in his heaven. The widow Charmian, despite a pressing invitation to stay from Hilda, had gone back to Guildford, and the first prosecution I had undertaken seemed likely to be a winner. As I have said, I find it very difficult to embark on any case without being dead set on victory. May it please you, my lord, members of the jury, I appear in this case with my learned friend, Mr. Claude Erskine Brown, for the prosecution. The defense of Christopher Jago is in the hands of my learned friends, Mr. Samuel Ballard and Mr. David Inchcape. As I uttered these unaccustomed words, I had the unusual experience of the scarlet judge on the bench welcoming me with a sort of ingratiating smile he usually reserved for visiting Supreme Court justices or extremely pretty lady plaintiffs entering the witness box. Did you say you were here to prosecute? That is so, my lord. Members of the jury. Mr. Justice Oliphant, as was his wont, spoke to the ladies and gents in the jury box as though they were a group of educationally subnormal children with hearing defects. Mr. Rumpole is going to outline the story of this case to you in perfectly simple terms. Is that right, Mr. Rumpole? I hope so, my lord. So my advice to you is to sit quietly and give him your full attention. The defense will have its chance later. This reference caused Soapy Sam Ballard to lift his posterior from the bench and smile winsomely, an overture which Mr. Justice Ollie Oliphant completely ignored. Ollie comes from the Northern Circuit and prides himself on being a rough diamond who uses his robust common sense and doesn't shrink from calling a spade a bloody shovel. I hoped he wasn't going to try to help me too much. Most acquittals occur when the judge sickens the jury by over-egging the prosecution pudding. So we went to work in number one court. The two neat Fabians, father and son, sat in front of me. The man in the dock couldn't have been a greater contrast to them. He was tall, 2 or 3 inches over 6 feet, with a winter suntan that must have been kept going with a lamp, as well as visits to Marbella. His hair, clearly the victim of many hours' work with a blow-dryer, was bouffant at the front and at the back swept almost down to his shoulders. His drooping moustache and the broad bracelet of his watch were the colour of old gold, and his suit, like his car, might have been described as electric blue. He looked less like the cowboy Roger Fabian had called him than a professional footballer whose private and professional life is in a continual mess. He lounged between two officers in the dock with his long legs stuck out in front of him, affecting alternate boredom and amusement. Underneath it all, I thought, though, he was probably terrified. So there I was, opening my case to the jury in as neutral a way as I knew how. I described the little mews house as I remembered it when I went to inspect the scene of the crime. The cramped rooms, the chill feeling of the home unused, the African carvings and weapons on the wall. I asked the jury to picture the girl from the estate agent's office who was waiting in the hallway with the front door left open to greet the man who had telephoned her. Who was it? Was it Mr. Morrison? Or was that a name she had used to hide the identity of someone she knew quite well? I took the jury through my theory that the literate Veronica had picked the name of the author of a book with Jago in the title. Then I waited for Ballard to shoot to his feet, as I would have done had I been defending, and denounce this as a vague and typical Rumpolean fantasy.
I waited in vain. Ballard was inert. Indeed, there was an unusually contented smile on his face as he sat, perhaps deriving a little passive sensual satisfaction from the close and perfumed presence of his instructing solicitor, Miss Tricia Benbow. The defense will no doubt argue that there is a real Arthur Morrison who met Veronica Fabian in the Mews and killed her before Jago arrived on the scene. Once again, Ballard replied with a deafening silence as he stared appreciatively at the back of his solicitor's neck. My instincts as a defender got the better of me. Jago may have been a crooked estate agent with a lamentable private life and an appalling taste in suits, but he deserved to have the points in his favor put as soon as possible. That is what you are going to argue, Ballard, isn't it? I said in a sotto voce growl, which resulted in no response whatsoever. In any event, members of the jury, we intend to call evidence to prove that Jago was seeing the dead girl quite regularly, meeting her in a public house called the Benedict Arms and having long, intimate conversations with her. There will also be evidence that he told the police that he'd never seen her before in his life. Mr. Justice Oliphant was like the helpful wife who always supplies the punchline to the end of her husband's best stories. I was coming to that, my lord. Well, come to it then, Mr. Rumpole. How long is this case expected to last? My reaction to that sort of remark was instinctive. It will last, my lord, for as long as it takes the jury to consider every point both for and against the accused and to decide if they can be sure of his guilt or not. I felt happier now, at home in my old position of arguing with the judge. Ollie opened his mouth, no doubt, to deliver himself of a little more robust common sense, but I went on before he could utter. The police decided not to charge Jago because there was no apparent motive for the crime. But if he knew Veronica Fabian, if they had some sort of relationship, they may have had to consider why he ran from that house where Veronica was lying dead and told no one of what he had seen. And finally, members of the jury, it is for you to say why he lied to the police and said he never met her. And then I repeated the sentence I had used so often from the other side of the court. You won't convict him unless you are certain sure that the only answer is he must be guilty. That is what we call the golden thread that runs through British justice. So we began to call the evidence, produce the photographs, and listen to the monotonous tones of police officers refreshing their memories from their notebooks. When I was defending, such witnesses presented a challenge, each to be lured in a different way with charm, authority, or lofty disdain, to produce some fragment of evidence which might help the customer in the dock. Now all I had to do was let them rattle on, and so prosecuting seemed a dull business. Then we got the scene of the crime officer, who produced the fatal knobkerrie, its end heavily rounded, still blood-stained and protected by cellophane, as was the 3-foot black handle. Ballard, who had sat mum during this parade of prosecution evidence, said he had no questions. What about the fingerprints? I could no longer restrain myself from hissing at my so-called opponent, a foeman who at the moment was hardly worthy of my attention, let alone my steel. What about them? Ballard whispered back in a sudden panic. Jago's aren't there, are they? Of course not. By now my whisper had become entirely audible. There are no fingerprints at all. Mr. Rumpole, the voice of robust common sense trumpeted from the bench. I thought you told us you appeared for the prosecution. If Mr. Ballard wants to ask a question for the defense, no doubt he'll get up on his hind legs and do so. I rather doubted that, But in fact, Soapy Sam unwound himself, drew himself up to his full height, and said, as though a brilliant idea had just occurred to him,
Officer, let me put this to you. There are absolutely no fingerprints of Christopher Jago's on the handle of the weapon, are there?
There are no fingerprints of any sort, my lord.
I'm very much obliged. Thank you, officer.
Ballard bowed with great satisfaction, and as he sat down, I heard him tell his junior, Inchcape,
I'm glad I managed to winkle that out of him.
Later, we got the officer who had been in charge of the investigation, Detective Chief Inspector Brush. And even though he was, for the first time in recorded history, my witness, I couldn't resist teasing him a little. Tell me, Chief Inspector, after the body was found, you spent a good deal of time and trouble looking for Arthur Morrison.
We did, my lord.
In fact, Morrison was always your number one suspect.
He still is, my lord.
You don't accept that Arthur Morrison and Jago were one and the same person?
There was a pause, and then,
I suppose that may be a possibility. And that Arthur Morrison is nothing but a dead author?
I don't know much about dead authors, Mr. Rumpel.
There, at least, the Detective Chief Inspector was telling the truth. If you had known that whether or not Morrison existed, Jago had been meeting the dead girl regularly, would that have made any difference to your decision not to charge him? There was a long silence, and then Brush admitted,
Well, yes, my lord, I think I might.
Let's use our common sense about this, shall we? Don't let's beat about the bush, Ollie intervened. Jago told you he'd never met the girl. If you'd known he was lying, you'd have charged him.
Yes, my lord.
Well, there we are. Members of the jury, we've got that clear at last, thanks to a little bit of down-to-earth common sense. Mr. Justice Oliphant had joined me as leader of the prosecution. And that might have been that. But there was one other question someone had to ask, and I couldn't rely on Ballard. You first questioned Mr. Jago because you had discovered that his car had been parked outside 13A Gissing Mews at the relevant time.
Yes.
You had no idea that he'd been into the house and found the body?
At that time, no.
So he volunteered that information entirely of his own accord?
That's right.
Was that one of the reasons he was not charged?
Well, that was one of the reasons we thought he was being honest with us, yes.
I sat down, having made Ballard's best point for him. Of course, he had to totter to his feet and ruin it.
So far as that goes, Chief Inspector...
Ballard stood, pleased with himself, rocking slightly on the balls of his feet.
Do you still think he was being honest with you about the way he found the girl?
I'm not sure.
Brush paused and then gave it back to the poor old darling right between the eyes.
If he was lying to us about not knowing the girl, I can't be sure about any of his evidence, can I?
Mr. Justice Oliphant wrote down that answer and underlined it with his red pencil. The Fabians looked as though they were slightly more pleased with the way Ballard was doing his case than with my performance. But no doubt they'd be too polite to say so. At the end of our evidence, we called my old friend, Professor Andrew Ackerman, Ackerman of the Morgue, with whom I've spent many fascinating hours discussing bloodstains and gunshot wounds. He testified that Veronica Fabian had died from a single heavy blow to the frontal bone of the skull, consistent with an attack by the Knobkerry, Exhibit P1. I asked him if this must have been a blow straight down on her head, and he agreed. He said that the position of the wound ruled out the possibility of it having been struck from either side. I felt that this evidence was important, but at the moment he gave it, I didn't realize its full significance.
Sir, you're defending.
I expect you have Ms. Liz Probert's full approval.
I was disarming in the robing room, taking off the wig and gown, when I found myself sharing a mirror with young David Inchcape.
What do you mean?
Well, she thinks prosecuting's as bad as aiding merciless landlords evict their tenants.
Well, I know she doesn't think you should be prosecuting.
And I rather think, I told him as I got on the bow tie and adjusted the silk handkerchief, that Mr. Justice Ollie Oliphant would agree with her.
By the way, I think we're doing pretty well for Chris, don't you? He's promised us a great party if we get him off.
Dave Inchcape had fallen into the defender's habit of first-name familiarity with alleged criminals. I walked back to Chambers with the still-despondent Erskine Brown, who had just been cut dead by Ballard and La Belle Benbow as they were coming out of the Ludgate Circus Palais de Justice. By the way, Claude, I said, what was that case you meant to have pinched from Inchcape all about?
Please.
He looked at a passing bus as though tempted to dive under it.
Don't remind me of it.
But what was the subject matter? Just the gist, you understand.
Well, it was a landlord's action for possession. Nothing very exciting.
Ah, he wanted to turn out a one-parent family.
No. I think there were a couple of ladies in the gay rights movement.
Oh, really?
Yes, he said they were using the place to run a business. Why do you ask?
Because, I tried to encourage him, the evidence you've just given me may be of great importance. But Claude didn't look in the least cheered up. No two characters could have been more contrary than Christopher Jago and his defense counsel. Jago lounged in the witness box, flashed occasional smiles at the jury, whose female members looked embarrassed, and the males stony-faced. He was a bad witness, truculent, defensive, and flippant by turns, and Soapy Sam was finding it hard to conceal his deep disapproval of the blow-dried, shiny-suited giant he was defending. As I had called several witnesses who said that they had seen him with Veronica in the Benedict Arms, Jago no longer troubled to deny it. He said he first saw her in the pub at lunchtime with another girl from Fabian's, whom he knew slightly, and he bought them both a drink. Some time after that, he saw her eating her lunch in a corner, alone with a book, and he talked to her.
"Well, what did you talk about?" I asked when I came to cross-examine. The house business, prices and that around the area. I didn't chat her up, if that's what you're suggesting. She wasn't the sort of girl I could fancy, even if I weren't pretty well looked after in that direction.
He gave the jury one of his least endearing grins. So why did you meet her so often?
I just happened to bump into her, that's all.
It's not all, is it? Your meetings were planned. She entered 5 or 6 appointments with Morrison in her diary. To my surprise, he didn't answer with a blustering denial that he and Morrison were one and the same person. Had he forgotten his best line of defense, or was he overcome by that strange need to tell the truth which sometimes seems to attack even the most unsatisfactory witnesses?
All right, then, he admitted. She seemed to want to see me, and we made a few dates to meet for a drink around the Benedict.
Why did she want to see you?
Well, perhaps she fancied me. It has been known.
He looked at the jury, expecting a sympathetic giggle that never came.
Well, I don't know why she wanted to meet. You tell me.
No, Mr. Jago, you tell us. There was a silence then. Jago looked troubled. I thought that he was afraid of the evidence that he would have to give.
She was a bit scared to tell me about it. She said it would mean a lot of trouble if it got out.
What was it, Mr. Jago? I was breaking another of the rules and asking a question without knowing the answer. At that moment, I was in search of the truth, a somewhat dangerous pursuit for a defense counsel. But then I wasn't defending Jago. He answered my question then, quietly and reluctantly.
Well, she was worried about what was happening at Fabian's.
I saw my clients, the father and son, listening, composed and expressionless. They didn't try to stop me, and by now it was too late to turn back.
What did she say was happening at Fabian's? Well, she said they gave the people who want to sell their houses very low valuations. And then they sold to some friend who looked independent, but who was really in business with them. The friend sold on at the proper price, and they shared the difference. She reckoned they'd been doing it for years, on a pretty big scale, I imagine.
Gregory Fabian was writing me a note, quite impassively. His son was flushed and looked so angry I was afraid he was going to shout, but his father put a hand on his son's arm before he passed me his message. I remembered that Roger had said Jago practiced the same fraud the Fabians were now being accused of.
Oh, why do you think she told you that? I asked Jago.
And then I read Gregory's note. He's trying to ruin us because we know he killed Veronica. Stop him doing it, he had written.
Ah, she told me because she was worried. I was in the same business. She wanted my advice. Well, like I said, perhaps she fancied me. I don't know. She said she hadn't got anyone else, no real friend she could tell about it.
I thought of the lonely girl who was trapped in a business she couldn't trust, pinning her faith on this unlikely companion. Perhaps she thought her confidence would bring them together. At any rate, they were an excuse to meet him.
Mr. Jago, when you called that Gissing Muse that morning, well, like I told you, I was interested in the place for a client. I phoned Veronica, and you kept the appointment and found her dead in the hallway.
Yeah.
Well, why didn't you telephone the police?
Because I was afraid.
Afraid you'd be arrested for a murder?
No, not afraid of that.
Of what, then?
There are moments in some trials when everyone in court seems to hold their breath waiting for an answer. This was such an occasion, and the answer when it came was totally unexpected.
I thought she'd been done over because she'd told me what the Fabians were up to. I thought that might be you, Christopher, if you get involved any more.
Roger Fabian couldn't restrain himself now.
You killed her!
He shouted. Ollie Oliphant muttered some soothing words about understanding the strength of the family feelings, but urged the young man to use his common sense and keep quiet. I did my best to pull myself together and behave like a prosecuting counsel. I asked Jago to take Exhibit P1 in his hand, which he did without any apparent reluctance.
I'm bound to put it to you, I said, that you and Veronica Fabian quarreled that morning when you met her in the Muse house. You lost your temper and took that knob carry off the wall. You swung it up over your head.
And as I said the words, all the pieces of the evidence came together and locked in one clear picture. Christopher Jago was innocent of the murder we had charged him with, and from that moment I was determined to get him off.
The case began and ended in the little house in Gissing Mews. I asked Ollie Oliphant to move the proceedings to the scene of the crime, as I wished to demonstrate something to the jury, having taken the precaution of telling my opponent that if he wanted to get his client off, he'd better support my application. So now the cold, gloomy Mews house, with its primitive carvings and grinning African masks, was crammed to the gunwales with legal hacks, jury members, court officials, and all the trimmings, including, of course, Jago and the Fabians. In one way or another, as many of us as possible got a view of the hall, where I stood by the telephone impersonating, with only a momentary fear that I might have got it entirely wrong, the victim of the crime. I got Jago to stand in front of me and swing the club in order to strike my head. I was not entirely surprised when neither Sam Ballard, QC, nor Mr. Justice Oliphant tried to prevent my apparent suicide, although Claude Erskine Brown did have the decency to mutter,
"Oh, mind our rumpel, we don't want to lose you."
Everyone was watching as the tall, flamboyant accused lifted the knob kerry and tried to swing it above his head. He tried and failed. When I cross-examined him, I remembered the cramped rooms and low ceilings of the Mews cottage. Now, as the club bumped harmlessly against the plaster Everyone present understood why Jago could not have struck the blow which killed Veronica Fabian. Whoever killed her must have been at least 6 inches shorter. It was my first prosecution, and I had managed against all the odds to secure an acquittal. A few days, it seemed a lifetime later, I was alone with Gregory Fabian in his white early Victorian house in Little Venice. "Why did you get him off?" he demanded. "Did you want an innocent man convicted?" I replied. "That's a stupid question. Of course you did." He said nothing, and I went on as I had to. "You said there's always one child who needed protecting. But you weren't thinking of Veronica, were you? You were talking about your son." "What about Roger?" "What about him? Odd, his habit of accusing other people of the things he did himself." "What did he do?" Gregory was quiet, unruffled, still carefully courteous in spite of what I'd done to him. "Oh, come on, I think you know, don't you? The racket of undervaluing homes so that you could sell them to your secret nominees. He accused Jago of doing that, just as he accused him of Veronica's murder." The house was very quiet. Mrs. Fabian was upstairs somewhere resting. God knows where Roger was. Even the traffic sounded far away and muted in the darkness of an early evening in January. "What are you trying to tell me?" "Oh, what I think, that's all." "Oh, don't worry, I'm not setting out to prove anything. One prosecution was more than enough for me." "Oh, go on, then." He gave a small sigh, perhaps of resignation. "Veronica discovered what was going on and didn't like it. She asked Jago's advice, and I expect he told her to keep him well informed, and no doubt so that he could make something out of it when it suited him to do so. Then I think Roger found out what his sister was doing." "Well, she wasn't his real sister, was she?" "She was the wanted girl child who had arrived after he was born, the child he was always jealous of. I expect he found out she had a date to meet Jago at the Mews house. He went after her to stop her. I don't think he meant to kill her. Of course he didn't. The father was still trying, I thought, to persuade himself. He lost his temper with her. They quarreled. She tried to telephone for help, and he ripped out the phone. Remember, that's how they found it. Then he took the knob kerry off the wall. He's short enough to have been able to swing it without hitting the ceiling, but you know all that, don't you?" Gregory Fabian didn't answer, relying, I suppose, on his right to silence. "You wanted Roger to be safe. You wanted him to be protected forever. And the best way of doing that was to get someone else found guilty. That is what you paid me to do. To be quite technical, Mr. Fabian, you paid me to take part in your conspiracy to pervert the course of justice. I have told Henry to send your money back." He stood up then and moved between me and the door. I thought for a moment that the repressed violence of the Fabians might erupt and he would attack me. But all he said was, "Poor Roger." "Poor Roger? What about poor Veronica? You should never have stopped her becoming a novelist." I walked past him and out of the house. I heard him calling after me, "Mr. Rumpel!" But I didn't stop. I was glad to be out in the darkness, breathing in the mist from the canal, away from a house silenced by death and deception. I decided to walk a while from the Fabian house, feeling that I had, among other things, to think over what remained of my life. It was while I was brooding on this that I heard the sound of revelry by night and noticed that I was passing a somewhat glitzy Art Nouveau pub picked out in neon lights called the Benedict Arms. I remembered that this was the night of Christopher Jago's celebration party. Accordingly, I called into the saloon and was immediately told that the orgy was on the first floor. Music, which sounded to my untrained ear very like the sound produced by a pneumatic drill pounding a pavement, shook the windows. There were a number of metallically blonde girls in skirts the size of pocket handkerchiefs and tops kept up by some stretch of the imagination, and a fair number of men with moustaches whom I took for down-market estate agents. And, of course, the lawyers, both prosecuting and defending. They had clearly begun, with the exception of the doleful Erskine Brown, to enjoy the party. Wandering on into the throng of celebrators, I saw Bollard in close proximity to his grateful instructing solicitor, Tricia Benbow. It seemed to me that Soapy Sam had been the victim of some passive alcoholism, no doubt absorbed from the glass he held in his hand. Then, under the sound of the pneumatic drill, I heard the shrilling of a telephone, and I was hailed by Jago, who had answered it. "Ah, Mr. Rumpel, it's a clerk. He says it's urgent." "Oh, all right. For God's sake, turn off the music for 5 minutes, will you?" I took the telephone from him. "Henry? I got an awkward situation here, Mr. Rumpel. The truth of the matter is, Mrs. Ballard is here." "Oh, bad luck." She happened to come out of her sprains and fractures refresher course, and she wanted to meet her husband. She said..." Henry's voice sank to a conspiratorial murmur in which I could detect an almost irresistible tendency to laughter. "He told her he was going to a Lawyers' Christian Society meeting tonight and might be late home. But she wants to know where the meeting's being held so she can join him, if at all possible." "Henry, you didn't tell her he was at an orgy in the Benedict Arms, Maida Vale?" "Oh, no, sir. I didn't think it'd be well received." "Well, why involve me in this sordid web of intrigue?" "Well, we don't want to land the head of Chambers in it, do we, Mr. Rumpel?" "Not in the first instance, anyway." Our clerk was positively giggling. "Well, where is the wife of Bollard now?" "She's in the waiting room, sir." "Put me through to her, Henry, without delay." And when Mrs. Ballard came on the line, I greeted her warmly. "Matey, Marguerite, this is Horace Rumpel speaking."
"Horace, whatever you're doing there? And where's Sam?"
"Ah, well, I'm afraid Brother Bollard can't come to the phone. He's busy preparing to induct a new member."
"A new member? Who?"
"Me."
"You, Horace?"
The ex-matron sounded incredulous. "Yes, of course. I've decided to put away the sins of the world and lead a better, purer life in future."
"But where are you meeting?"
"Ah, now, I'm afraid that can't be divulged over the telephone."
"Why ever not?"
"For your own safety, Marguerite. I think it's better for you not to know. We've had threatening calls from militant Methodists."
"Oh, Horace, are you sure Sam's all right? I can hear a lot of voices."
"Ah, yes, it's a very full house this evening. Hold on a minute." I held the phone away from my ear for a while, and then I told her, "No, Sam really can't get away now. He says he'll see you back in Waltham Cross, and don't wait up for him. He'll probably be exhausted."
"Exhausted?"
She sounded only a little suspicious.
"Why?"
"It's the spirit," I said. "You know how it tires him."
Is he filled with it?"
Her suspicions seemed gone, and her voice full of admiration. "Oh, yes," I assured her, "right up to the brim." I put down the phone, and the blast of road-menacing music was restored. I then approached our head of chambers, who was standing with Dave Inchcape, Tricia, the solicitor, having danced away with her liberated client. "That was your wife on the phone," I told him.
"Good heavens."
The man was still sober enough to panic.
She's not coming here, huh?"
"Oh, no. I gave her a perfect alibi. I'll tell you about it later." I'll also tell you my solution to the case of the altered brief. I'm getting into the habit of solving mysteries. I'd better go and find Liz. Inchcape seemed anxious to get away. No, you stay here, David. I spoke with some authority, and the young man stood looking anxious. We are all but toys in the hands of women, and your particular commander-in-chief is Ms. Liz Probert, I told him. I know you come into the clerks early to see what's arrived in the post. All white wigs do. To your horror, you found that you'd been engaged by a flinty-hearted landlord to kick two ladies active in gay rights out of house and home. How could you face your cohabitee if you did a case like that? It was the matter of a moment, members of the jury. I addressed an imaginary tribunal. For David Inchcape to scratch out his name and print Mr. Claude Erskine Brown in block capitals.
Is this true?
Ballard tried his best to look judicial, although he was somewhat unsteady on his pins. David Inchcape's silence provided the answer. I was rather late home that evening, and climbed into bed, muttered to Hilda's sleeping back, "From now on, old thing, I promise you, Rumpel only defends."